And getting ready for the next show, there's a troop of animals coming into our studio, climbing up on the stools, hanging from the light fixtures, and there is an African leopard who's leapt up onto a stool and is about to introduce our show.
Welcome, everyone, to Animal Voices. In this program, we explore the relationship between humans and other animals, animal welfare, vivisection, endangered species, and many other subjects. What you place on the end of your fork has profound implications for the environment. The increased demand for animal products has resulted in a vast reallocation of resources, has promoted the degradation of global ecosystems, and has had a devastating impact on human health. Many of the main environmental issues, desertification, fresh water availability, ocean pollution, biological diversity, rainforest destruction, topsoil erosion, and climate change, are directly and severely impacted by the Western world's current animal-based diet with its intensive agriculture. In the last 10 years, extensive medical studies have reported that Westerners are eating a diet containing excessive amounts of protein, saturated fat, cholesterol, pesticides, and not enough fiber. This diet is creating spiraling medical costs, killing people, and destroying the environment, and is largely responsible for the disappearance of small family farms and the growth of corporate agribusiness. Environmentally, the export of Western eating habits is similar to the export of toxic chemicals and toxic wastes. All nations and regions must look to growing their food locally, honoring the knowledge and value of the men and women who farm. These measures will provide food security, environmentally sound agriculture, healthy food, and rural development. You're listening to CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio. Within a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Professor T. Colin Campbell, and at the half-hour mark, we will contact Anneliese Zorg from the No Whales in Captivity. And then we will contact Chris Wailomo, who will inform us about EarthSave's fabulous festival of health called Taste of Health. And that will be on Saturday, Sunday, October the 1st. My name is Carl Loskin. Alan Jensen is in the control room. In the studio today, we have Jenna Hunt, John Pranger, and Marge Adams. And over to Marge. Marge, you have a little short bit there.
Yes, thank you, Carl. This is a short item from the San Francisco Chronicle and about the recent devastation in the southern United States, but this is a happy story about animals. Instead of meeting their fate in a Mississippi slaughterhouse, 1,000 lucky chickens will live out the rest of their lives in sanctuaries and backyards. The bird savior, Kim Sterla, who runs an animal sanctuary, said she wasn't alone in the mission. She was joined by several employees of the Humane Society of the United States and an animal sanctuary volunteer from New York. The group rescued the chickens from a badly damaged Mississippi poultry farm. In just two nights, the group collected over 1,000 birds, including 19 that had been bulldozed into a burial pit with thousands of dead chickens and inches of maggots. Thank God we walked by that pit one last time, said Sterla, describing the difficult conditions the group faced. Sterla also rescued two black kittens from a garbage dumpster. So some good did come.
Thank you, Marge. And over to Jenna. She has a short note. We have Professor Colin Campbell online, but we'll, Jenna, could you just give us an introduction here?
Sure. In the Canadian Press current release, the BC government unveils plan for the Spirit Bear Sanctuary. The endangered bears indigenous to BC's west coast may soon have a new sanctuary after government and stakeholders release their recommendations for a land use agreement Saturday. The recommendations on land use for the north and central coast regions were made by two planning tables composed of stakeholders including First Nations, resource industries, and conservation groups. But the Rain Coast Conservation Society, which did not take place in the table talks, contends both the land use plans fall short of protecting species and their habitats. No one in their right mind can claim that the Great Bear Rainforest is saved, said Chris Genovalli, executive director for the Society, in a release. The Society is concerned about the protection of other species in the area. Thanks.
And a little message, a public service message from Life Force. Life Force is losing their garage storage office space. So if anyone in the Vancouver area can help them keep their files and library, etc., to carry on their work, you can call Peter Hamilton, the Life Force Society, at 604-649-5258. You can also email lifeforcesociety@hotmail.com. Any kind soul who can help them out, very much appreciate it.
Thank you, John and Jenna. Professor T. Colin Campbell will be the keynote speaker at EarthSave's Taste of Health, and that's going to be held on Saturday and Sunday, October 1st and 2nd, at the Croatian Cultural Center, 3250 Commercial Drive. Professor T. Colin Campbell has been a researcher, lecturer, and policy advisor in the field of diet and cancer for nearly 40 years. He co-authored a book called The China Project, and this study, called the Cornell-Oxford China Study, was hailed as the most comprehensive survey of the connection between diet and disease in world medical history. The New York Times hailed this investigation directly from Cornell University as the Grand Prix of all epidemiological studies. These discoveries have vigorously challenged and altered existing conceptions about nutrition and health. We have Dr. T. Colin Campbell on the line. Welcome to Animal Voices. Are you there?
Yes, thank you.
And, you know, maybe you can just tell us a bit about this gigantic China study and why it is so significant.
Well, it was a big study, and the fact that it was significant was primarily due to the fact that the cohort being studied in China was a group of people, a large group of people in rural China, who were consuming, in some areas of the country, almost no animal-based foods, and in other areas, up to maybe 20% of the total calories of animal-based foods. In other words, it was a cohort that hadn't really been studied before in Western studies. Most of the Western studies deal with people who are carnivores or virtual carnivores, and these people were consuming very little of the animal-based foods. And we also looked at this question between diet and disease in a very comprehensive manner, measuring as many things as we possibly could that might bear on the question, as well as many different kinds of disease outcomes. So it was this comprehensiveness that really made it kind of unique.
I wonder if you could give us some idea of how you went about distinguishing between rural and why it was called the China study.
Well, it was a China study, of course, because it was in China and it was directed from Cornell University, where I've held a professorship for many, many years, but also included the University of Oxford, as well as senior Chinese academies, government academies. It was in rural China, and the way we distinguished it primarily was by population density and also by the ratio of industrial to agricultural, commercial activity. Those were the two key indicators.
Now, the people in the rural areas, what kind of diet do they have in China?
Well, in the rural areas, as opposed to the urban areas, and incidentally, this study was originally done in 1983 and 84, It was repeated again in the late 80s, early 90s, but nonetheless, it was the early 80s. And so it had those, you know, mostly a plant-based diet. And in the urban areas, like most societies, they consume more animal-based foods, more commercial foods, whereas in rural China, they were consuming more of the whole foods and mostly whole plant-based foods. Also, the people in the rural areas tended to live in the same regions all their lifetimes, which, of course, is almost required for a good epidemiological study. Between 90 and 94% exactly of the people in these different villages that we surveyed were born in the counties in which they were surveyed. And we actually surveyed a total of 130 villages across the country. And they were selected in such a way to take advantage of this huge, big differences between disease rates in different counties across the country.
Now, what did your studies find about obesity and diabetes, which is so endemic in cities at this time?
Well, at that time, obesity and diabetes really did not exist, hardly at all in the rural area of China. It's since become a fairly serious problem, as you may know, in the urban areas of China as they've begun to change their diet, and also to some extent in the rural areas as well. I mean, in the last 25 years in China, they've become more westernized as far as their dietary practices are concerned. They've chosen our bad habits, unfortunately, and, you know, used our kind of food. And as a result, are in fact now seeing much more obesity and, of course, its corollary, diabetes.
In the editorial today, I talked about that Western diet, with the Western diet, it is equivalent to exporting toxic chemicals and toxic wastes. Would you agree with that?
Yes, to some extent, if you can keep the concept of toxicity somewhat broad, because most of the time toxicity is referring to specific chemicals, if you will, environmental chemicals, which are, of course, are noxious and nasty at times, and they get distributed. But I consider also the question concerning the toxic diet to be one that doesn't have enough of the whole plant-based foods, and it has, in fact, too much of the commercial foods and too much of the animal-based foods.
Now, that's a surprising thing to hear from a person who grew up on a dairy farm, and one of your initial projects at Cornell University was to study the proteins and how to produce them more efficiently.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I was raised on a dairy farm, as was my family for generations, and I was milking cows until I went away to school, and in fact, did my doctorate at Cornell University doing a research project trying to figure out, in effect, how to grow cows more efficiently so we could eat more of them and drink more of their milk. So that's quite a departure for me from my original, you know, personal background, you know, to come to terms with the evidence that we got.
So what was this road to Damascus that suddenly made you realize that there was different types of protein and that it made you turn to a vegetarian diet?
Well, it was a number of things, and it evolved over many years. I mean, it's been just about 50 years ago since I started my research with my students and other colleagues. But in the beginning, it really had to do with a survey of malnourished children in the Philippines and discovering, in fact, that the few children who were consuming, you know, the highest protein diets, for example, are the ones most likely to be getting certain kinds of cancer. And that went on then to our exploration of that question, you know, the relationship between protein and cancer in the laboratory. And we learned essentially that in the laboratory we could virtually turn on and turn off tumor development or cancer development experimentally simply by giving them milk protein or taking it away or substituting it with plant protein. I mean, that was the background, and it was startling, and it was substantial, it was major. Others had, done enough work to substantiate this. We learned a great deal how it worked, and so when the China study came along, I was interested in expanding the question beyond just the protein. I mean, protein is obviously very important, but it's only one of the nutrients, a major one, and albeit a major one, it's only one of them that's present in the plant and animal-based foods. So when we got in the China study, I was really interested in sort of posing the hypothesis, you know, of the differences between plant and animal-based foods, you know, rather generally, and not just for cancer, but other diseases as well, to see if this applied to other, you know, in a broader context.
Now, so, what is amazing is to hear you say that you could literally turn off and on the growth of these cancers with with some of these proteins, and you mentioned milk protein. Now, this is what's being promoted in China at this stage. Where were they consuming China milk previously in China?
No. I mean, almost all the... We surveyed 130 villages in the initial survey. We surveyed 130 villages in great detail across China. And of those 130 villages, only about three or four, consumed any amounts of dairy, and it was a rather different kind of dairy. It wasn't cow's milk necessarily. It was, you know, it was camel milk, goat milk, sheep milk, and things like this. And they were actually using it primarily, you know, as a very hardened kind of cheese that they dried on their rooftops, or they were using it to some extent in their tea, you know, the liquid. But it's very, I mean, in many ways, there were almost no Chinese consuming any dairy. And so we weren't really getting our answers from studying the Chinese so much in respect to dairy, although we did have a, you know, a study on the side doing that. But it was, you know, going into a larger question of just animal-based foods as opposed to plant-based foods and their relative effects on health and disease.
Now, I know you're partly retired and after spending so many years in research, and... you must be watching with some kind of interest this tremendous interest in China and what it's doing, what they're doing to the environment, and also that you know, the Chinese have traditionally been very keen on hogs and pig, eating pig, and this is if everybody had to have a car or everybody had to eat a high protein diet with animal diet, that would place very enormous strains on the environment and also on the grain supply, because they're feeding these animals with grains. I mean, what do you foresee there with this voracious consumption?
Well, if it were to go on as they are now going, it will be a disaster. Economically, health-wise, and other environmentally, and of course they're going to have to import grains in order to feed these cattle if that's what they choose to do. Unfortunately, only to produce, you know, very expensive diseases. So, I mean, I really see a very serious problem, and I know that they cannot continue on that road. But they're not different really from many other societies, you know, that started to get capital and wealth. And one of the first things that people tend to want to do as they go through a sort of industrial, you know, revolution in a sense, is as soon as they start getting some money, they want to eat animal-based foods and higher-fat diets. And we've all learned from other societies, and they are, I'm sure, going to be learning themselves. That's not a good thing to do. Makes a lot of money for people, but it really doesn't make any health.
We're getting quite a bit of static on your phone, but what we'll do is, you know, you're going to be in Vancouver next week.
Yes.
And we really welcome you here because you'll be speaking at the Earth Save Taste of Health, and you're going to be the keynote speaker there. We'll just give the details here, and maybe just give us an overview of why Earth Save considers it such a privilege to have you here.
Well, it's a nice thought for them to consider a privilege, but basically, I, with my son Tom, wrote a book called The China Study that now is in the marketplace, is doing extremely well, and so we're pleased for that. So I'll be talking about what we have in the book. It's a fairly substantial book, readable for the public, yet scientifically reliable as best as we could make it. So a lot of it's really about the book, about my views on the relationship between diet and health, and diet and the environment, I should say. I mean, this diet that maintains health and prevents disease does it for individuals, but also does it for societies. I mean, the cost of medical care, the degradation of our environment, the violence that occurs in the world. I mean, all these are obviously major, major things that's now occurring in our society, and they're connected. They're connected to what we decide to eat. And so this is really what I want to talk about.
Well, we certainly look forward to hearing you in Vancouver at Earth Save's Taste of Health, 1st and 2nd of October, Saturday and Sunday. So thank you, Dr. Professor T. Colin Campbell, and look forward to seeing you.
Well, thank you very much. I shall look forward to seeing you. Okay, bye.
You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And we're going to go over to Alan Jensen, and he has a little tune for us. So, you ready? Thank you, thank you. I think that's Schubert's Trout Quintet, a wonderful piece of music. So, well, we have been speaking to Professor T. Colin Campbell, who will be at the Taste of Health on the 1st and 2nd of October at the Croatian Cultural Center, and that's on 3250, that's Commercial Street, and so Commercial Drive. So, there's going to be a whole host of events happening there, and it's a food festival. It's everything tied together. And at later on this program, we will be contacting somebody from Earth Save Canada who will tell us every reason why you should come to this wonderful food festival. And it's all about animal-based diets and the modern intensive animal agriculture, and that we know that it violates the basic ethical mandates. And the mandate is to preserve our health, treat animals with compassion, protect the environment, and conserve natural resources. Yeah, the future of our planet is imperiled by the production and consumption of animal products, and EarthSave has the message. Over to Jenna.
Yes, and this is from the excellent book Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet by Anna LaPay. And she writes, in the face of the unprecedented ecological and social crisis, our organs of mass media rarely do more than reinforce the notion that global corporate capitalism is our only hope. They feed us messages that the only way to feed the world is with huge agribusinesses, relying on massive infusions of pesticides and chemical fertilizers, and on giant feedlots pumping cattle with tons of grain, hormones, and antibiotics. We seldom hear about the ways in which this highly concentrated factory farming system is rapidly destroying the resources we need to ensure our long-term well-being. How often are we alerted to the fact that this system is a root cause of new threats to our health, ranging from heart disease to mad cow disease, to the weakening of antibiotics protection. And, of course, EarthSave will be dealing with ways to have a healthier planet, a healthier bodies, and a healthier economic system. Thank you.
Covance has dropped its lawsuit against PETA Europe. Covance Laboratories has been working overtime on damage control after undercover video footage taken by a PETA U.S. investigator exposed the company's cruel treatment of animals. Unable to convince a court to prevent the public from seeing how monkeys are systematically abused in its laboratories, Covance has dropped its lawsuit against PETA Europe, an action that marks the latest in a string of legal victories for animals in the fight against a giant drug testing conglomerate. Covance must also pay PETA Europe's legal costs associated with the case. Shortly after PETA U.S. went public with an 11-month investigation inside a Covance laboratory in Vienna, Virginia. We talked about that last week with our PETA liaison officer. Covance requested an injunction preventing PETA Europe from showing the shocking video footage. On June 16th, a United Kingdom judge dismissed that case, characterizing the video as highly disturbing. The judge also commented on the rough manner in which the animals are handled and the bleakness of the surroundings in which they are kept, matters which he said cry out for explanation. In contrast to the abuse uncovered by Peter U.S., Covance's animal welfare statement claims that the company treats the animals in its facilities with care and respect. The judge called the difference between Covance's claim and the reality exposed by the Peter U.S. investigation a comparison between two different worlds. And he went on to say that where Covance has fostered a misleading impression, Peter Europe is entitled to correct it publicly. He then ordered Covance to pay Peter Europe £50,000 for its legal costs. Covance appealed the judge's decision, but following a preliminary review in which the Court of Appeals described that case as an uphill task for the company, Covance withdrew its appeal on July 25th. This increased the amount of legal costs that Covance must pay for Peter Europe. In the United States, Covance's censorship attempts also have failed when it had to withdraw motions for both a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction, which were aimed at preventing Peter U.S. from showing the video. Covance is still attempting to sue Peter U.S. for placing an undercover investigator in his laboratory, but its failure to gag either Peter U.S. or Peter Europe means that the public and the media will be able to watch the undercover footage as the case unfolds. If you want to see this footage, go to covancecruelty.com. That's C-O-V-A-N-C-E, covancecruelty.com.
Yes, this is Marge Adams. My guest today is Annalise Sorg, who is the founder and director of the organization The Coalition for No Whales in Captivity. The Coalition has been trying to get a question on the November the 19th Vancouver civic election ballot regarding the keeping of whales in captivity. The organization believes that Vancouverites should have the right to tell the Parks Board through a referendum whether we approve or disapprove of the keeping of whales in our city. Now, here is Annalise Sorg. Hello, Annalise.
Hi, Marge.
Nice to have you back on the air.
Thank you so much.
Will you tell us all about what's happening with this proposed referendum?
Well, we've been asking for the last five civic elections, so that's almost 15 years, Marge, we've been asking for the government to allow Vancouverites to have a say on the issue of keeping whales in captivity. As you know, it's a very important issue in Vancouver. It's always front page news. It's always first in the 6 o'clock news, but the aquarium has put very much pressure on the Park Board, which is really the ruling agency here, not to hold referendums. So once again, it's election time, and we thought that this time it would be easier to get a question on the election ballot and get it approved by the Park Board and the City Council, because we have so many COPE commissioners on the Park Board. COPE has eternally been opposed to keeping whales in captivity, and we expected that this would be a simple thing, but it turns out the aquarium is still putting a lot of pressure, and we're still not sure whether we will be able to have a question on the election ballot that would ask Vancouverites, are you in favor of keeping whales and dolphins in Stanley Park?
Years ago, we did have a referendum, didn't we, on the zoo?
The question was, are you in favor of a zoo in Stanley Park? And a majority of Vancouverites voted no. And that's why the zoo was phased out, and now we have beautiful green space. In this case, we're not asking to close the aquarium. We're not asking about the rest of the animals that they keep in there. We're asking how Vancouverites feel about keeping whales and dolphins.
Yeah, but it's still an underwater zoo, isn't it, really?
That's all it is, really. It's a marine park. It's a popular attraction for tourists. About 70% of people that go to the Vancouver Aquarium are from outside Canada. Very few members, certainly 15,000 members is what they've had for the last 10 years. So it's not Vancouverites, really, that are attending these whale shows. And I think Vancouverites are very much aware of how greatly whales and dolphins suffer when they're taken away from their families, captured, and put into these tanks where they just spend the rest of their lives doing stupid pet tricks for the tourists.
And there has been a loss of life there, which appears to be because of the incarceration, doesn't it?
Of course, of course. There's been 3 baby orcas and 2 baby belugas, and they're, according to our calculations, because of course the aquariums never open about this, we figure that there's been about 24 to 26 whales and dolphins that have died in the hands of the aquarium staff.
That's a very large number, isn't it, for a small aquarium? And at least it seems to me it's a small aquarium.
And yes, it is. The problem, of course, is that there is, when you put animals in captivity and they die, they have to replenish the tanks because the show must go on. So they really don't tell you, you know, that it, not just with the whales and dolphins, of course, the octopus has to be replaced every 6 months or so. I mean, the animals in captivity don't live that long. And then, you know, the people go in there, they just see whales and dolphins and other critters that they think are always there, but they're not.
How does the life expectancy compare for a whale in captivity as compared to in the wild?
For instance, the orcas in the wild, we know that there's a couple of what we call grandmothers out there. They're about 97 years old. And it's easy for female orcas to get to be 90 or so. Males are more, die between 60 and 70. It's pretty much like a human life. They get through puberty at the same speed that we do, if you will. Their infancy, it's very, very parallel to humans. In captivity, if a whale lives 20 years in captivity, it's a long time. So it really shortens the lifespan. Now, with all the information we have now about whales and dolphins, it's really immoral that the aquarium is still continuing to exploit these animals. We have been successful. In 1996, we passed a bylaw in Vancouver that did restrict the aquarium to a certain point with the importation of these animals. Unfortunately, they managed to place in a couple of loopholes for the aquarium to continue doing business as usual. But by 2001, the pressure was so great that they stopped keeping orcas in captivity. And now there are 4 belugas and 2 Pacific white-sided dolphins still suffering in those tanks in Stanley Park.
Is there an effort to bring in more, or is it pretty well stabilized of what's there now?
Well, there's always efforts to bring in more. The only reason that they haven't been able to is because we've made sure that they can't expand, because this is something that the aquarium has always gone to the park board to ask for more Stanley Park so that they could make whale pools bigger. The problem with bigger whale pools is that they need more whales to fill them up, because this is a show. You can't have, a big tank and have a couple of whales that are at the opposite end of the tank of where the public is. So that's why they have to have more whales all the time. And they just imported another dolphin. They swapped a beluga for a dolphin with SeaWorld. And, of course, everyone will remember that a baby beluga died in July. So, you know, it's just a really bad situation here in Stanley Park. I think Vancouverites have had enough with watching baby whales die in our backyard and the suffering and the cruelty. If Vancouverites voted that they didn't want any polar bears and monkeys and seals in the zoo in Stanley Park, I think Vancouverites would vote in a majority to stop keeping whales and dolphins in captivity. And that's why the aquarium is putting pressure and not allowing the government to give Vancouverites a right to have a say in this election.
So how do we go about helping the coalition to get this on the ballot?
Please help. First thing I want to say is there will be every week, and there has been for the last couple of weeks, an update in the Georgia Strait newspaper. The website is strait.com, strait being S-T-R-A-I-T. IGHT.com. And if you look under Straight Talk, there's articles all along. This battle is being fought by a couple of COPE members who managed to get the COPE membership to vote in favor of holding this whale referendum. Unfortunately, the five park board commissioners from COPE have pretty much blocked it, but we're still trying. So for you listeners, if you want to stay in touch with the Georgia Strait every Thursday, read the newspaper, and of course with Animal Voices, we will be updating you every week. And if you want to help, if you could write a letter to the Vancouver Park Board and ask the commissioners to please allow us to hold a whale referendum, their website, their email address is PB as Park Board, pbcomment.bc.ca. And for those of you without a computer, if you can fax a letter, it's 604-257-8427. And our website for the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity is whaleprotection.org. Send us an email, send us your letter. Again, the email address for the Park Board is pbcomment.bc.ca, and the fax is 257-8427. We would very, very much appreciate you writing to the Park Board and helping us put the pressure. As I said, this is the fifth election that we're trying to get a whale referendum, and it's about time we did.
Thank you so much for this, Annalise. You certainly and your group have put in many years of work on the issue and deserve all the support we can garner through Animal Voices.
We very much appreciate that, Marge. It's always a real pleasure to be with you on the radio.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based, your community-sponsored radio station. So we're going to, many of our programs can be heard on our webpage, www.animalvoices.org, animalvoices.org. Yes, so we're one of only a very few radio programs that extend kindness and promote it on the air in North America. Many years, have you been enjoying the wonderful sweet corn that's been around Vancouver lately and coming from Chilliwack and Abbotsford areas? Well, I certainly have. And last week, Rick Keating came into the studio here, and I've known him many years ago when he took over an apartment that I'd been renting, and he dropped off one of his CDs. So now over to Alan Jensen, and we're going to listen to Rick Keating and Something About Corn.
Most of my life I've been working these fields, but still wonder struck at the beauties they yield. I break up the ground, spread the manure, stand there wide open, and I never feel sure. Can I wait out the drought? Can I last through this storm? It's not driving the tractor, it's growing. Sunshine and rain getting deep in the dirt. It's a prayer in your heart, so sweet that it hurts. It's fear and it's trust. It's your love taking form. It's not driving the tractor. Lots of songwriters learn.
burn the trade well when they're driving their tractors all over hell. They look so impressive out there in the sun. You walk home empty when the picking is all done. And I shout in the wind all my sorrow and scorn. It's not dry.
Well, that was Rick Keating telling us about corn, and he has a couple of CDs out. So over to John Pranger.
Last week we told you about, we had an interview with PETA, and we discussed the Covance Sick Science, where their Covance Laboratories is using, is a contractor for many companies who want their drugs tested. And I just want to read to you a little bit from their magazine, Animal Times, which is just a great magazine, incredible pictures. And in a study named The Grease Pit, because the this was named Grease Pit because the test substance was thick and greasy, so the researchers call it the Grease Pit, the monkeys learned to shut their mouths in an effort to prevent having the tube stuck down their throat, the tube through which this greasy substance would enter the stomach of the monkeys. And the technicians then used a bite bar to put between the monkeys' teeth so that they couldn't shut their mouths. PETA's investigators videotaped one of her co-workers repeatedly hitting a monkey named Ninja in the face with a heavy plexiglass bite bar because he wouldn't open his mouth. When he still wouldn't open up, another worker held the monkey's nose while the first technician told the monkeys, "You're stupid today." When the next grease pit monkey was caught for dosing, a technician screamed at him, "You son of a bitch." The other technicians used the sharp end of the bite bar in an attempt to pry his mouth open, and the first technician yelled, "You're going to kill him," to which she replied, "I'll ram it down his effing throat." And that's the kind of people that in charge of our health and forming the basis of medical science today. And I'll just end with a little quote from a Dr. Bertrand P. Allison, who said, "Orthodox medicine condones ill conduct and seeks to restore health without rectifying it. True health can't be attained in this manner. Animal experimentation has no philosophy, no ethics, and no width of vision. It will, therefore, disappear in the course of time." And I'd just like to, just adding to that a little bit, that the animal researchers often accuse the anti-vivisectionist of anthropomorphizing animals and turning them into little people. But in fact, that's what they do. And you see from this conversation, from the attitude and from the language where they're addressing this monkey as if it were to behave like a human being and cooperate with his torturers, the most extreme anthropomorphism and the projection of their own thoughts and feelings onto a monkey, and then treating the monkey as if it had no feelings at all. It's just an incredibly insane situation, and we need to get rid of that very, very soon.
Hi, this is Marge Adams once again. I'm thinking back to our earlier telephone guest, Professor T. Colin Campbell. He alluded to the relationship between diet and crime and violence. And I thought this article from Ode Magazine, September the 26th of this year, was an interesting one along that line. And it's entitled, "You Do What You Eat. The Solution to Crime and Violence is on Your Plate." At first glance, there seems nothing special about the students at this high school in Appleton, Wisconsin. They appear calm, interact comfortably with one another, and are focused on their schoolwork. And yet, a couple of years ago, there was a police officer patrolling the halls at this school for the developmentally challenged students. Many of the students were troublemakers. There was a lot of fighting with teachers, and some of the kids carried weapons. What happened? A glance through the halls provides the answers. The vending machines have been replaced by water coolers. The lunchroom took hamburgers and French fries off the menu, making room for fresh vegetables and fruits, whole grain bread, and a salad bar. Is that all? Yes, that's all. The article cites many other examples and studies relating to nutrition and the behavior. It concludes, "We need to know more about the composition of the right nutrients. It could be the recipe for peace. I heartily agree. Where does most, what country eats the most meat?
Yes, thank you, Marge. You know, to go on to what John Panger just said about vivisection, it was that.
Is this Chris?
In the United Kingdom, it said that 64% of experiments in the UK were conducted without anesthetic whatsoever. 64% of the experiments on animals were conducted without any anesthetic whatsoever. All of the animals either die as a result of the experiments or they are destroyed at the end of the experiment. And it's just an incredible number of animals that are used for so-called science. Would you go to a vet for your if you had an ailment? According to the vivisection statistics that published by the UK government, 2.66 million animals were subjected to experiments likely to cause pain. That's what they said. Suffering, distress, and lasting harm. So we have Chris Wailomo on the Ilomo on the line. She is organizing a wonderful Feed Your Senses Taste of Health. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Carl. How are you doing?
Well, we're just doing fine, but you must be organizing so many things, and you're sounding so calm and relaxed.
Well, we're trying to pretend we're calm and relaxed, but you're right. There's a lot of finishing touches that are being pulled together for the show, because we're hoping it's going to be one of the best yet. So,
well, it's always been, Taste of Health has always been an event that should be marked in your calendar. But what's happening this year?
Well, I think one of the nice things is that the Taste of Health is actually opening on October 1st, which is on a Saturday, but it also happens to be World Vegetarian Day. So that's one nice thing that's great. We've got a great lineup of speakers that are coming across, and I think you're interviewing a few of them on your show, actually, Carl, aren't you? You've got Eric Marcus. There's Dr. T. Colin Campbell coming in, who's very exciting. He's published his book, The China Study, which is the largest study ever done on the impact of diet on health. And it actually completely changed the way he looked at his own food habits and his family's food habits. We've got returning Brendan Baser. And along with Brendan, he's going to be joined by Tanya Kay and by Robert Cheek. And they're actually going to be sitting on a panel talking about being vegan athletes and also talking about a film that they've just recently featured themselves in that's going to be released in mid-November. And we're hoping at the show to be able to show a trailer of that particular film. So then as well, in the workshop areas, we've got some great workshops lined up. There's one on how you feng shui your kitchen, because obviously Feed Your Senses, it's all about food, so you want to make sure you have a great environment in that sense. We've also have got a great panel on GMOs, genetically modified food ingredients and so forth. What do you need to know and what you can do about it? So that panel has been set up, and that's just actually coming together today, so I'm really excited about that one. And we've got another great session, which is on hemp, and it's from nutrition right down to cloth. So it's the full range in terms of the world of hemp. And we've got some great, great workshops as well, just in terms of cooking demos. Dorina Burton's going to come in this year. She's doing a couple of presentations. Sally Airy's going to come on. She's doing a cooking demo plus a workshop on good and bad fats. And then Brianna Clark-Gorgon is coming on. She's going to be doing a special session on holiday food prep for vegans. You know, obviously we've got the Thanksgiving coming up and then shortly afterwards Christmas, so those are areas that she's going to be focusing on.
Now, one of the things is that we all like to do is we like to eat. And there will be not any, there'll be many appetizing aromas and dishes there to show you the wonders of a, what kind of diet?
Well, there's, in terms of the various, we've got, first of all, you got the Try and Bite exhibit. So we've got some food vendors. But we also have the restaurants. And this year we've got a couple of exciting ones. We have got Cheesecake, which is actually a Canadian first. It's a creamy, rich-tasting alternative to dairy-based cheesecake. It's actually soy-based, and it's made locally with organic ingredients. So that's one thing you definitely want to go to try and taste. We've got Returning Greens and Gourmet Food Restaurant. There's Ratty Yoga, Rebellious Tomato Pizzeria, who does this fabulous vegan pizza. Seduced, so there's all kinds of exciting things. And then you were asking about what other things are the food tasters?
Well, it's there's going to be samples that I know there's always everybody wants you to try. The manufacturers like to sample. They give out samples, free samples of their products.
Yeah, we're going off, and then when you're talking really about a try and buy it market, I know for sure that we got a couple of exciting vendors who are brand new this year. Micella Foods, they do a whole range of different Indian-style cuisine. There's also Indian Elements. She's actually a new startup out of British Columbia, and this is going to be one of the first shows that she'll be exhibiting at, and she'll be sampling her food items there. We are going to be giving out samples of Galaxy Cheese, the soy-based cheese products, and as well, we've got some English Bay, which is a vegetable-based beverage that has no soy in it, so it's slightly different, but again, it is dairy-free, so that's actually quite great to be there. And then we've got Tasty Eat. They're coming on. They do a soy vegan jerky product. There's just so many different booths that people are going to be able to stop and try it, and then also be able to actually buy it at special show-stopping prices, we're hoping. So, and then the returning ones, like the Tofutti Cuties, I think they'll be back. They'll be standing on one corner, and then Hard Bite Potato Chips, they'll be returning, and they're actually out of Maple Ridge. So it's nice to see a lot of local producers, but also some new people coming in from different parts of North America.
So that's going to be an all-around festival for everybody. There's, you can attend the lectures, cooking demonstrations. There'll be entertainment. There'll be musicians. Dana Lyons is going to be there. And, people want to really have a look at the more finer details here. Let's give us the venue and the web page.
Yeah, now the best place, the one thing that's brand new this year is that we have actually switched to the Croatian Cultural Center, which is on Commercial Drive at 16th Avenue. And the best place to get the most up-to-date information, go to www.tasteofhealth.com. So that's www.tasteofhealth.com. Or you can also call the EarthSave offices, and they have all the information on the answering service as well. And the telephone number there is 604-731-5885. That's 604-731-5885. And the other thing new this year, too, is we've actually got a kids' zone, too. So we're really encouraging families to come out and partake as well, because we want to make sure that everybody's having a fun, entertaining time this year. And we really need the people to come out and enjoy it, because that's what part of the fun's all about.
And you're also catering to different cultures this time. There's going to be some in multi-languages, is it, some of the programs?
Yeah. There's actually really, and I kind of wish I actually spoke either Cantonese or Mandarin, because there's a couple of really exciting workshops that have been set up. For example, they're doing one session on turning the backyard into a healthy vegetable garden, the five myths of a vegetarian diet, wellness knowledge that you cannot afford not to know about. So that will be taking place both on Sunday and on Saturday, and they're going to be taken up in the eggplant workshop room. The other thing that I might want to mention, if you've got any early rises, the show starts at 10 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday. And on both days, we're going to be handing out for the first 225 people coming through a special gift bag that's got samples of some pasta and some soy beverages and other wonderful things that the Healthy Shopper Program provided to us.
So now the cost is of the admission is?
If you're an EarthSave member, it's free. So that's absolutely wonderful. That's good. And now are you still a member, Carl? I hope you are.
And then I'm a sustaining member.
I think you probably are, definitely. I appreciate all the support that you give us, absolutely. And then for the general public, $7 at the door. But if you look around the city and if you happen to be one bookshop or yoga studio, watch out for the $2 discount coupons, because you can bring those to the show as well. And tickets are available at Capers, Choices, Banyan Bookstores. Who else have I missed out here? I know there's one other location. Sweet Cherubim, actually on Commercial Drive.
So what a wonderful thing you're doing, and you'll have a good relaxing time afterwards. But that's 1st and 2nd of October at the Croatian Cultural Center, 16th and Commercial. And we're going to do, I'm going to give my phone number here, and for the first two people to phone, they're going to get a free ticket to the Taste of Health, EarthSave's Taste of Health.
Aren't you going to ask a special question at all, Carl?
The special question is, no, I think just the first two people who phone.
Oh, you got lucky listeners.
If it was like $100,000 prize, maybe we would, but the admission could be worth all of that, because health is wealth.
That is true. That is super.
And if you like to eat this this feed of the senses, taste of health, promoted by EarthSafe, is for you. So the number to call right now is 604-924-4966, and the first two callers will get two free tickets. Each one will get two free tickets to the Taste of Health. So the number again is 604-924-4966. And the winners will be confirmed. I will phone them. And there we are. So thank you for being on Animal Voices. We appreciate what EarthSafe does. Teaches people about the health, environmental, and ethical consequences of our food choices.
Thank you so much, Carl. And I'm looking forward to seeing you at the show. And hey, they get to meet you there in person as well. That's perfect.
And we have, thank you. And we have, do we have anything here, Marge?
There's something interesting about talks and warnings on tuna. Could I read that one? Okay, this is from ABC 7 News. The Food and Drug Administration told California that the state's attempt to require mercury warnings on tuna conflicts with federal law. California's Attorney General disputed the FDA letter and said it was an attempt to stop a lawsuit the state has filed against tuna companies over the warnings. The federal government has no authority to prevent warnings that provide truthful, important information to consumers, said spokesman for California Attorney General Bill Lockyer. A year ago, Lockyer sued the nation's three largest canned tuna companies to enforce Proposition 65, California's 1986 law requiring businesses to provide clear and reasonable warnings when they expose consumers to known reproductive toxins, such as mercury. The companies are tri-union... I guess I've run out of time, have I?
Just finish that.
Okay. The companies are Tri-Union Seafoods, makers of Chicken of the Sea, Del Monte, makers of Starkist, and Bumblebee Seafoods, makers of Bumblebee. So that certainly gives you food for thought, doesn't it?
Thank you, Marge. And you've been listening to another edition of Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7. In the control room has been Alan Jensen, and we have had here John Pranger, Marge Adams, and Jenna Hunt, and my name is Carl Loskin, and we'll be back next week with another edition.